This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. For people who've experienced armed conflict, no aspect of life remains unchanged. Not intimacy, getting a good night's sleep, not even a trip to the mall. Here's author Phil Klei reading from a new collection of short stories about life in and after combat. Here, a Marine comes home to North Carolina after 7 months in Iraq.
So here's an experience. Your wife takes you shopping in Wilmington. Last time you walked down a city street, your Marine on point went down the side of the road, checking ahead and scanning the roofs across from him. The Marine behind him checks the windows on the top levels of the buildings. The Marine behind him gets the windows a little lower, and so on down until your guys have the street level covered, and the Marine in back has the rear. In a city, there's a million places they can kill you from. It freaks you out at first, but you go through like you were trained, and it works. In Wilmington, you don't have a squad. You don't have a battle buddy. You don't even have a weapon. You startle 10 times checking for it, and it's not there. You're safe, so your alertness level should be at white, but it's not. Instead, you're stuck in an American Eagle Outfitters. Your wife gives you some clothes to try on, and you walk into the tiny dressing room. You close the door, and you don't want to open it again. Outside, there are people walking around by the windows like it's no big deal. People have no idea where Fallujah is, where 3 members of your platoon died. People who've spent their whole lives at white. They'll never get even close to orange. You can't, until the first time you're in a firefight or the first time an IED goes off that you missed and you realize that everybody's life, everybody's, depends on you not screwing up. And you depend on them.
Phil Klei is a writer and a veteran of the U.S. Marine Corps who served 13 months in Iraq. His debut collection of short stories is called Redeployment and is being nearly universally praised for, as the New York Times Sunday Review put it, capturing the ways the conflict splintered the psyches of the men who fought it. And we welcome you, Phil Klei, to Word of Mouth.
Thank you for having me.
You attended Dartmouth College here in New Hampshire. You then joined the Marines, served in Anbar Province for a year, moved to New York City, got your MFA from Hunter. When in that process did you start writing these stories?
I started the first story in 2008, not that long after I got back from Iraq. I think you come back from going overseas, and there's just a lot of questions in your head, a lot of memories that you want to work through and think about and experiences of that either you had or that people that you knew had. And I think writing the stories writing that first story in particular was my entry point into thinking about these questions more deeply.
Is that why you wrote them in the first person? It's as if you were putting a little buffer between yourself and the stories.
Well, you know, I wanted to have a range of perspectives. It was very important to me to do that. I didn't want to come back and write the sort of, you know, this is how it was, I was there book. And I have nothing against those books, but just Iraq is such an incredibly complicated range of experiences for the people who serve there. And, you know, everybody goes and they have what they went through, and then they come back and they think about it in different ways, and they interpret it through, you know, through their experiences and the ideas that they've had. And I wanted to have all these different narrators who, in one sense, they'd give you a kind of composite view of the war, but also who would argue against each other. I thought that was very important for allowing the reader to kind of, you know, look at these different experiences and the different claims that these narrators are making, and then, you know, kind of critically engage with it.
Yeah, we do get narrators with a range of rank and age and experience and I think education in many cases.
Yes.
You, yourself, you were a public affairs officer in Iraq, which meant that you probably interacted with a real array of Marines and others. I'm wondering if that position as public affairs officer helped you channel the voices in your book.
Of course. I mean, it's an odd job, and I ended up, I ended up traveling through a lot of Anbar province. I ended up doing everything from, you know, going out with National Guardsmen on their way to meet with Iraqi police or do a patrol, and to sitting in on the battle update assessment briefs that went to General Odierno. And so you get a pretty wide range of interactions with a lot of people doing a lot of very different things. And that definitely went into the book, and I wanted to do justice to a lot of the different people that I had met, and just the variety and the complexity of what the war meant, and also what the variety and complexity of what it meant to come home from it.
Back in 2010, you wrote an article for the New York Times, and in it you wrote, "Though I continue to tell stories about Iraq, I sometimes fear that makes me a fraud." I'd like to dig into that a little. You were there.
Sure.
You served. Was it not enough not to be seeing action in the same way many of the Marines were?
It's a complicated thing. You know, there are all these little subcultures in the Marine Corps or in the military in general. And then, you know, one of the things that we think about in terms of war is a proving ground, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then when you come back, who has the right to talk about war? You know, is it the guy who's seen the most action? Is it the guy who got blown up and you know, was seriously injured? Or is it all of us? Should we all, you know, even citizens who didn't serve or didn't go overseas, should we be talking about war and critically engage with it? And ultimately, I feel that we all need to talk about these subjects. I think it's critically important that we do. But I think you need to do that with a sensitivity towards the type of experiences that you're talking about.
We're speaking with Phil Klei. He's a writer. He's a veteran of the Marine Corps, and he's the author of the book Redeployment. It's a collection of stories from the perspective of several Marines serving in and also returning from Iraq. A lot of these stories do center on soldiers returning home. Now, what was that experience like for you?
My experience was I think, a lot easier than most folks. As I said, I was a staff officer. I'd lived near a surgical facility where you'd have, you know, Marines, civilians, insurgents coming straight from the battlefield. And so you'd see things. And then I take a flight home right to New York. And I'm walking down Madison Avenue, and there's just zero sense that we're at war. It's very strange. It's very strange to be living, happy, comfortable life, going to grad school, when you know that people that you'd worked with or were friends with are deeply engaged in war and sometimes getting injured.
Yeah, so few Americans in aggregate really did experience this war. I'm trying to imagine that, what it must have been like for you. You know, there in New York City, you're in a writing program, people are sort of developing fiction, and you're thinking about, you know, stray dogs, you know, lapping up the blood of casualties on the street. I mean, what was that experience like for you? Over and over again, one of the things we hear in war stories or conversations with soldiers is that they understand something about each other that nobody else can really understand. What was that experience like for you? Did you have anyone to share it with?
I'm skeptical of that notion.
Tell me more.
You know, it's funny. Of course, there's a big disconnect. I went straight from the Marine Corps to, you know, MFA, and it's a different culture. I remember, you know, very early on, a buddy of mine, Bill Chang, sort of saying like, hey, you know, we should have lunch. And then at lunch goes, you know, Phil, maybe you should tone down the way you express things in creative writing workshop, because it's a little different from the Marine Corps. But one of the things that was tremendously important for me writing the book. So I had civilian readers. I knew a bunch of guys at the NYU Veterans Writing Workshop who were very important for me writing the book and working through these ideas and reading drafts. But civilian readers were equally important, and I think that's something that is easy to lose sight of. There are things that, because I was so focused on the veteran experience, that I had blind spots I didn't know about that civilian readers could point out to me. I think, you know, the notion that, you know, only the veteran has a voice in this conversation is really a really problematic notion, right? Mm-hmm. Because first off, we as a country go to war. The Marine does not issue himself orders, right? It's something that we do all together. So we're all a part of this. And then secondly, just interpersonally, I think there's a real value in talking to other people with experiences unlike yours who can offer you perspectives from a different angle that you would have never thought of. And that was crucial for me writing this book. And you know, because Everybody has narratives about themselves that they'd like to believe. Veterans are no different. And, you know, you get an outside perspective, a smart, engaged, respectful but critical civilian reader, or just somebody to talk to. They can offer you perspectives that are important that you never would have gotten otherwise.
Phil Klei, writer, veteran of the U.S. Marine Corps, served in Iraq from 2007 to 2008. His debut book of short stories is called Redeployment. You can find a link to more on the book, including some of the heartily embracing reviews at wordofmouthradio.org. Up next on Word of Mouth, technology meets the bandstand with a prosthetic arm designed specifically for drummers. We'll find out how it could give them the ability to hit nearly superhuman rhythms. But before that, a reminder that NHPR depends on listeners just like you to bring you the news and information and entertainment programming that you tune in for. Over and over, people who donate tell us how good it feels to help pay for their listening. Here's how you can help pay for yours.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Yesterday marked the final day of the 2014 Paralympic Games in Sochi, where hundreds of world-class athletes called upon years of training and some incredible custom-built equipment in hopes of going home with the gold. From skiing to skeleton, technology has helped disabled individuals compete at the very highest levels. The perks of advancing prosthetics are not limited to sports. Gil Weinberg is founding director of the Georgia Tech Center for Music Technology. He recently developed a robotic prosthesis for the drummer Jason Barnes, who lost an arm in an accident. Gil, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
So Jason had built his own prosthetic shortly after his accident, but it was pretty limited. What is it that makes drumming such a difficult activity to duplicate with an ordinary prosthetic?
So Jason is very creative, and he did use some springs and other equipment to build an arm that he can hit with because he still has an elbow, so he can move his arm. But drummers use their wrists and their fingers in a very expressive way. That's how you control the color of the sound. That's how you control how the stick bounces on the drum, and he couldn't control that. So when he saw some of my old robots online, I developed robotic musicians that actually play with humans, he asked me, can you please develop myoelectric, which is connected to the muscles, and you can get information from other muscles that you still have, and myoelectric arm that will allow me to control the operation of a wrist of a finger, which I don't have.
So the new prosthetic, robotic prosthetic that you designed looks a little like something that RoboCop might use if he were in a band. Can you describe it for us, and did it pick up those movements that Jason was looking for?
Sure. So currently it's pretty exposed. We are working on a shell for it so it would look slicker and nicer. The arm has two sticks. One of the sticks is connected to his forearm muscles, which we still have just below the elbow, mm-hmm. and it can flex and relax this muscle to actually operate the arm and operate how tight the stick is being held. So if the stick is being held tightly, you have a certain kind of sound and a certain kind of bounce on the drum, and you play drum rolls in different speed and so on. So that's basically what he wanted. But my research is also about creating new interactions between humans and robots. So I suggested to him to add another stick that will not be connected directly to his muscles or to any part of his body, but will actually have what I call a mind of its own. And by that I mean that there's a small computer chip on this stick, and it listens to the music that Jason is doing or playing. It listens to the music that other musicians are playing, and based on that, it enhances and plays back at Jason to create something interesting. And when Jason listens to his own arm, building on what he plays and kind of playing off him, he hopefully will be inspired to push his music to new directions. And that's what interests me in the research. So together we're able to have an arm that addresses his needs and also makes a nice platform for me to explore new ways to create human-robot collaborations, where the connection between the human and the robot is very intimate. It's actually part of your body.
Well, let's listen to just a clip of Jason practicing with the new prosthetic. And he's actually experimenting with it. It gives us a little bit of a sense of the evolution. Let's hear that. Wow, Gil Weinberg, tell us what we're listening to here. What did we just hear?
So the first thing we heard is how Jason, with his muscles, operates one of the sticks and creates some hits on the cymbal. Then we heard on the snare drum him actually pushing the limit of the speed that we have embedded in the arm and actually able to play much faster than any human. We have 15 hertz, meaning 15 times a second. Each stick can hit as fast as 15 times a second. So together it's almost 30 hertz, 30 times a second, which is much faster than human can. And even though that wasn't what we were aiming for, we actually created some superhuman capabilities with this arm that he likes to explore. And you hear him going back and forth on the skin of the snare and exploring different timbres with really, really fast drumming.
He's doing this with one arm and this other stick, this robotic prosthetic that you created, rather than two hands. Is that correct?
Right. Yeah. One arm controls two sticks, and together one arm can play up to 30 times a second. Mm. And then you heard some of the other instruments joining, and then we did some trading fours, which is a jazz kind of term, meaning the drummer is listening to some solo and improvisation from one musician, and then he answers with his own solo. And in this case, what we can do is take some of the improvisation from the musicians and actually embed it in the arm itself. So suddenly you hear the trumpet player would analyze what the trumpet player is playing and put it in the arm, and you hear the trumpet playing through your arm, which is, again, a new experience, maybe a new intimate connection between you and your fellow players, which hopefully will push music to new directions and create new interactions that will be interesting.
Oh, it was just fascinating to listen to and hearing you explain it even more so. But I'm wondering about Jason's particular condition. I mean, every disability is unique. And the prosthetic in this case was specifically fitted to this individual, what kind of things he was looking at, the kind of addition that you wanted to make and the work that you've done. Now, that sounds to me like it'd be quite a challenge, quite an opportunity, and quite expensive. How much did it cost to make this prosthetic?
So we received funding from the National Science Foundation for this research. And the funding is to fund students and to fund research and equipment and so on. So we cannot direct it to how much will a production version of this arm will cost. The grant that we received was close to $150,000, and we still have almost a half of it. So just the research phase is not maybe as expensive as some people may expect. If and when it becomes commercial, which I don't have any plans at this point, it probably can be much cheaper, because a lot of the money went to the research, to explore different directions that work, some directions that didn't work, and so on.
Gil Weinberg, I'm very interested in what you called another stick, a robotic prosthetic with a mind of its own, you know, which introduces a whole lot of things that either make people scared or quite full of wonder. Tell me about how this prosthetic works with a mind of its own.
So the mind of its own is mostly related to the second stick. Even in some cases, we put a mind of its own for the original stick as well. And what it does, it listens to the other musicians, it detects music, it tries to understand music like humans understand it, understand the rhythms, understand the chord progression, if there's some chords in it, understand what the tempo, how loud it's being played. So everything that is Jason controlling, and sometimes other musicians are playing, is being sensed and analyzed by this computer that operates the stick and brings it to some kind of a musical state of mind. So we're trying to develop artificial intelligence for music. And then based on that, it improvises. So if it hears There's a reason that it's sparse, maybe. It can decide for itself, I will fill it up. I will have some triplets and 16ths and 30 seconds note here because something is missing. If it listens to a particular pattern from a different musician that it thinks, that was an interesting rhythmic pattern, I want to repeat it, it will try to repeat it, maybe ornament it and change it a little bit to see how Jason reacts to it.
Yeah, it must be very exciting to play. In fact, Jason's going to be playing out with the device for the first time on March 22nd, soon enough, at the Atlanta Science Festival. Is he looking forward to showing off his new tool?
He's looking forward. He's also quite tensed and obviously excited about it. We hope everything will work. We're working around the clock to make it work. It's going to be in the Bailey Performance Center in Kennesaw State University on March 22nd, 8 o'clock, and it's free.
Gil Weinberg, thank you so much for joining us, and best of luck on the 22nd.
Thanks so much.
Gil Weinberg is founding director of the Georgia Tech Center for Music Technology, and he's responsible for a number of absolutely incredible projects that bridge the gap between robotics and music. You can see plenty of them, including an incredible video of drummer Jason Barnes playing with the prosthetic drum arm. The links are all at wordofmouthradio.org. Up next, Word of Mouth tips its tweed cap to the Irish this St. Patrick's Day with Paddy Maloney, the absolutely delightful founding member of the Chieftains. But before we get to that conversation, a reminder that NHPR's March Fund Drive is on, and we really need your support to make the radio that you turn to. Here at Word of Mouth, we sift through the daily onslaught of information to bring you stories that surprise you, inform you, and we hope brighten your day. That's because of your support. So if you value this program or any of the programs you hear on NHPR, please call now and support your own listening habit. Here's how. This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Back in 1975, the Saturday Night Fever soundtrack was on the top of the charts. Bruce Springsteen was on the cover of Time and Newsweek. Led Zeppelin made a double live album, and Earth, Wind & Fire were rockin' sequined bell-bottoms and afros. 1975 was also the year that the influential rock magazine New Musical Express chose the Chieftains as Band of the Year. That's Morning Dew, one of the songs from the soundtrack to the Stanley Kubrick film Barry Lyndon that put the traditional Irish band on the map. The Chieftains had been making music long before that, together since the late 50s. The band made its first album in 1962. 50-plus years later, the Chieftains have collaborated with artists from Luciano Pavarotti to the Muppets. And we are so honored to have Paddy Maloney, founding member, on the line with us. Welcome to the program, Paddy.
I'm delighted to be speaking to you, Virginia.
Well, here's the legend, according to Wikipedia, anyway. Your mother bought you a tin whistle when you were six, and at the age of eight, you started to learn the Ilian pipes. So were you raised in an environment that this music was alive or disappearing?
Well, it was. It wasn't hugely popular, let's put it that way. And there was great fears that rock and roll, that, you know, with the radio sort of coming into strength and that sort of thing, and Bill Haley and the Comets would take over, and this great folk art of traditional Irish music might die, you know, and to be seen walking down the street with a fiddle under your arm, you know, you get a slag, you know, and, from your schoolmates or workmates or whatever. That's all changed now, of course. They're looking for tickets for your show. But I did grow up in an environment. My grandfather was a flute player, so music in the family was part of the whole thing. That was the source of entertainment. Very little radio, no television, of course, in those days. And for me as a child, that 1 shilling and ninepence for a tin whistle got me going on it.
How much was it?
1 shilling and ninepence. That's
one
the old currency.
1 shilling and ninepence.
Yeah.
It all started there. And this was, you know, when you made your first album, it strikes me that Bob Dylan had just made his first record. The Rolling Stones had been formed. The Beatles auditioned for Decca. This was kind of the dawn of the British invasion. Were you living like rock stars at this time, Paddy?
No, not really. You know, I was looking at the Beatles there on the Ed Sullivan show. Well, we, in 1959, I remember being on holidays and I was drinking pineapple juice in those days in the west of Ireland. And this little pub where we used to take over every night, music and singing and dancing, 59 now. And it was just brilliant. But this American man came in one time wearing sort of like green trousers and dark glasses. And so he was enjoying the music. And he said, "Well, my name is Ed Sullivan. And I'm, you know, I have a TV show." And for me, television, I didn't even know about as much, you know, and wasn't into anything big or startling or anything like that in those days. And I'd love to have you on my show. "Oh, yeah," I said, "yeah, sure, yeah." So I thought it was just another one of the these people showing off, you know.
Oh, no.
And found out 12 years later who he was.
That was the moment. Well, I read several things about your influence in music and other stars of the time. And throughout the years, you've collaborated with loads of other musicians and in styles of music. You've explored country, Galician music, the music of Newfoundland. You've collaborated with the Rolling Stones, Tom Jones, Ziggy Marley, Madonna. What did you do with Madonna?
No, that was a bit of a farce. That it was our late harp player. He was a terrible character. Derek Bell put out a story. He said, "Well, I had breakfast with Madonna." You know, well, the Mayflower Hotel in Central Park, New York, was a place that all musicians hung out. You know, and they used to stay there. So Derek happened to be down having his breakfast, and the table next door was Madonna. So he put the thing out that he had breakfast with Madonna. You know? But he was a terrible character altogether, you know.
That was it? He just sat in the same room?
And she was a great admirer. And we went to, I remember going to one of her concerts in Toronto, I think it was, or Seattle, I'm not sure now. You know, that was as far as that got. We never actually did anything together.
We're speaking with Paddy Maloney, founding member of the Chieftains. I'd love to hear about some of these other collaborations. You also have famously collaborated and toured with Van Morrison. Now, I guess it's unfair to ask you which one of these artists that you've worked with was your favorite, but any pairing stand out for you that, you know, completely unexpected that really worked?
Well, who wouldn't say that the collaboration with Van Morrison should have worked, because he got a reputation, I don't know. And I think it's unfair, because he's just such a fantastic musician and great songs, and even to this day he's still at it, you know. And we did in fact go on tour together for a year, which was just an amazing on stage with Van and the Chieftains together, and it worked, you know. And then later years, you know, I got him to sing the song Shenandoah on the one of our albums, the Long Journey Home.
Oh, Shenandoah, as far I wander.
But Van was great to work with, you know. I mean, you had to tread lightly.
Yeah, what I hear.
Yeah, but him and I got on great, you know. I mean, there was that magic, that great thing interplay between the two of us, that between us and the Chieftains and Van, that really, you know, it came together easily enough.
Well, I'd love to get to another collaboration, which I thought was just fantastic. Catherine Coleman, she was playing at the International Space Station. She's a Canadian astronaut. She borrowed instruments from you, I guess, including a wooden flute from your bandmate and a tin whistle from you, Paddy Maloney. Tell us a little bit about how this happened.
Yeah, Katie Coleman, she went up into the space station and Matt's flute and my tin whistle. And it was up there for 6 months and 93 million miles. It went around the world. And I gave her a tune, and then she beamed down onto the internet, St. Patrick's Day wish, you know, happy St. Patrick's Day, and here's the flute. And so the DVD, you'll see where she actually takes the whistle and plays this little tune, Fanny Power. On the CD, I brought it back to Ireland, and I used the exact copy of what she sent, and I put Chieftains onto it, and so we play that in concert as well, and we show the video and we play along to it. You know? Mm-hmm.
I've seen it. She's floating around weightless. Let's hear from it. From backcountry Ireland to the International Space Station, what is it that makes your music so absolutely universal, so enduring?
This is it, and I suppose the world has become a small place now, even to be going up into space. We actually played with Chris Hadfield, mm-hmm. also the commander.
The Canadian commander, he did Moon Dance with you, didn't he?
He danced right last year. So we are spreading our wings with music.
I would say so.
It has no boundaries whatsoever. I mean, it's the music itself is appealing to everybody. You know, the music, you don't have to be Irish to like it or to know about it or to play it, for that matter.
Well, it's wonderful that you're so excited about the music, you know, 53 years in. Was there ever a point where you just thought, oh, I'd love to play something else? I mean, you'd been touring for decades on this music.
We have. It's the music itself. It's part of our whole being, our life. It would be so empty without it, you know. And at one stage, I was learning accountancy.
Wow.
And I'd go so far at night studying, you know, until Christmas. And then the parties would start and the music and take over. And I'd give it up and come back again the following year. So, but I actually worked at that sort of business for about 10 years.
Well, it would have been a tragedy if we had lost you to that field, I must say.
Well, I'm glad, you know. And my mother got a lover, you know. She was always saying to me, my wife, terrible thing about Patty, never got himself a decent job, you know. And and everything was going, I used to say, it's going grand, everything is good, you know, you should be happy. When Trinity College decided to give me an honorary doctorate, I was... Van Morrison was there sitting beside my mother, who was 83 at the time, and she was all dolled up and hat on. So she was lucky. So we never heard any more about the good job or decent job after that, you know. She was convinced I must be all right, doing okay.
Well, Dr. Paddy Maloney, what a pleasure to speak with you.
Thank you very much, Richard. Lovely to speak with you.
Lovely to speak with you, too. There's more information on the Chieftains at wordofmouthradio.org. All of the contributors and conversations you hear on NHPR are brought to you by you. It is listener support that allows us to present not only quality news and analysis, but programs that speak to your sense of curiosity and wonder of the world. If you rely on New Hampshire Public Radio to shed a little light on new corners of creativity or innovation or happenings in the world, let us rely on your support. Here's how you can help.